Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Brian Cox's proper title is Professor of Particle Physics at the University of Manchester, but he's been called everything from a celebrity astrophysicist to the natural successor to David Attenborough. The former musician turned physicist has also presented landmark series such as Wonders of the Solar System, and he's due to come back to Ireland with his Horizon Space Odyssey tour this October, and he joins me now. Good morning, Brian Cox.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. Listen, I have to start on muons. Physicists seem to be buzzing this week over them. Can you just explain what this is and what it could be?
Yeah, so the muon is a little subatomic particle. It doesn't really matter what it is. I mean, just by way of introduction to it, they're getting made now in what we call cosmic ray collisions in the upper atmosphere, and they're passing through the room that you're sitting in, and some of them are hitting you, and Ooh. Some of them are going through these tiny little things, and we don't really notice them. So they're an exotic kind of subatomic particle. But in this case, we're just using them as a probe, really, as a little probe of nature. And what's been discovered is that they behave differently to the way we'd expect. And what that says to us is that there's some kind of other, probably some kind of other particle that we don't know about, that we haven't discovered, that's present in nature, that's making these little muons behave in a different way to what we expect. So it's really the discovery, if it's confirmed, of either a new particle, a fundamental building block of the universe, or perhaps, and it's kind of related, a new force of nature.
Wow. Now, I was reading your Twitter feed and you're saying this is important, this is exciting. I mean, is it getting close to the discovery of new physics, say, beyond the Standard Model?
Yes. Yeah, it is. I should say this signal was first detected about 10 years ago now at a different laboratory called Brookhaven, also in the United States, but in New York. And this now is a different experiment in Chicago, and it's detecting the same signal. So that gives us some confidence. The reason everyone's just a bit careful is because we have a bar, if you like, above which a signal has to get before we absolutely say, well, this is a discovery. And it's not quite there yet. But this experiment, they've only analysed about one-fifth of the data that they have. So within the next 12 months or so, we will know whether this is a real signal of real new physics or not. But it is looking good.
And if it was a real signal, say 12 months down the road, it's discovered and proved that it is, what I don't understand, and maybe a lot of my listeners don't understand, and you're brilliant at explaining this to people who are not physicists, what would that mean for our universe? Why would that matter?
Well, we're talking about asking a question, which is a fundamental question. It's a curiosity-driven question at the moment, which is, what is the universe made of? So what are the small building blocks of the universe? And what are the forces that hold those things together? So these are things like gravity and magnetism that stick the magnets on the door of our fridge. And for about the last, I would say, 50 years, really, we've had a picture of the world, of basically 12 building blocks of matter, and this thing called the Higgs boson that famously was discovered a few years ago, and then four forces of nature. And so if this turns out to be something else, then we are learning more, a lot more, about the fundamental structure of the universe.
Were you a curious child?
Yeah, I mean, in particular about astronomy. I became interested in those points of light in the sky. One of my great heroes, Carl Sagan, I don't know if you remember, he made this wonderful series called Cosmos back in the 1970s. And he tells this wonderful story about he looked at those points of light and he asked his family and his friend, what are those things? And someone just said to him, they're just lights in the sky, kid, And then, but he went to a library, he remembers going to a library with his mum, I think it was, and getting a book and opening the book, and he found out they were other suns. These things are worlds. They're not points of light, they're stars like our sun. And now we know, since the 1990s, that most of them have got planets. And so when you, if you go out tonight and it's a clear night, and you look into the sky and you see those points of light, they've got solar systems around them. There are planets there, and there are moons around those planets. And suddenly your imagination begins to wander, and you think, what are those worlds like? This is what I discovered quite early, fortunately. The more you know about nature, the more fascinating it becomes.
And did you always want to be a physicist? You mentioned, obviously, Carl Sagan there, and obviously his TV series, Cosmos, A Personal Journey. Apparently that was seen by at least 500 million people across 60 different countries. But did somebody like him, did he inspire you?
Definitely. I, at the time, was, you know, late 70s, there really wasn't very much on television. There wasn't very much television right then, you know. So to see 13 episodes of this exploration of the universe in just presented in the way that he presented it was tremendously inspiring to me. The reason it's continued to inspire me, actually, and this sort of feeds into the work that I do, is that Carl Sagan was never afraid to link those discoveries and that curiosity-driven exploration of the cosmos to our situation here on Earth and to politics and to the way that we behave. It was a very famous 13th episode of Cosmos where he said, you know, and it applies to us now, that if you think about what we are, you know, we're just atoms. The building blocks of you and me and everybody that's listening, they're as old as time. They've been around since the beginning of the universe, 13.8 billion years. They're spending a bit of time in this pattern, which is, we call me and you. And these atoms have been able to think, right? So and wonder and find beauty and terror, indeed, in the universe. And that's a remarkable thing. And the idea that we could risk that. Remember, at the time, this is the height of the Cold War, things like the Cuban Missile Crisis, fresh in his mind when he wrote this, that the idea that we could risk all that is kind of almost like a betrayal of the universe in some kind of sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the fact that it's taken 13.8 billion years to assemble us, and we carelessly throw it away. But it was remarkable to me that somebody made a program about astronomy, but told us what that means for our everyday lives.
And of course, he famously spoke, you know, what you're talking about there, but the pale blue dot.
Yeah. It's the most beautiful image, I think. One of the most beautiful images ever taken. It was taken by the Voyager 2 spacecraft at his behest. It was Voyager 1, actually. We'll get letters. The Voyager spacecraft. At his behest. And it's a picture of the Earth beyond the orbit of Neptune. So Voyager 2 went to Neptune. And so it's a picture from many billions of miles away. And it's a single pixel of light, which is the most distant image of our planet ever taken. And he turned that into this beautiful essay. You've clearly read it. I recommend it to anyone to just look up on the internet, Carl Sagan, Pale Blue Dot, and read it. And it had the sentiment that I've just expressed, actually, and it beautifully, poetically. That I remember some lines that he said, think of all the rivers of blood that have been spilled by all the generals and emperors who wanted to fight over the temporary possession of a piece of a dot, like a tiny piece of that pixel. And it's such a beautiful reflection on an image that if you don't know what it is, it's nothing, the image. But the moment you know it's our world seen from 4 billion miles away or whatever it was, then the moment you find that it becomes deeply meaningful.
It's really beautiful. And I think he said as well, Brian, you look again at that dot, that's here, that's home, that's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you've ever heard of, every human being, whoever was, lived out their lives. I mean, it's incredible when you think about it.
Yeah. And he goes on, I think this, the next line is something like every superstar, every politician, every young couple in love. It's just beautiful. Everybody lived there on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. It's Carl Sagan.
It's beautiful. Of course, he went on to write a sci-fi novel, Contact, and became a movie with Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey. He might do that too, Brian.
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful film, that. I really like that film. And it's dreaming again. It's dreaming about contacting someone else out there in the universe. And in a sense, I mean, that's part, I mean, you mentioned the live show that I'm doing. It's part of that. you know, we all ask deep questions, right? Are we alone in the universe is one of them. What does it mean to be human? What is our place in the universe? Those are questions that we ask. And I think that while science won't give you the answers to those questions, you know, questions about meaning, what it does is provide a framework within which we can think. Mm-hmm. So you need to know. If you want to know what is my place, what is our place in the universe, you need to know that we are on one planet in orbit around one star amongst 200 billion stars in one galaxy amongst 2 trillion galaxies in the observable universe. And that's one view of our place. Another view, though, is that I think, if I was forced to guess, that there are very few of those planets out there amongst the stars where atoms have come together to think and ask the question, what is my place in the universe? So I think that there's 2 almost contradictory ideas come out of science, and it's in the space between contradictory ideas that interest in things lie. And the contradictory ideas that I think is that because of our rarity, probably, we're extremely valuable, notwithstanding the fact that we're physically insignificant.
I suppose as a species, we think of ourselves as pretty important, and that's maybe only natural when we haven't met anyone else as clever as us, alive in the solar system or galactic neighbourhood. Mm. But is it that you want to explain to me, we need to remember how small we really are?
There's an element of that, because we are obviously small. We can't get away from that. But as I said, we're also, I think, extremely valuable. As Carl Sagan said, the astronomy is humbling and character building. It's character building because this tremendously unlikely position we have, that the fact that we can think and feel and bring meaning to the universe, locally at least, is something that I think we need to value. But there's the other thing I'm really interested in at the moment is black holes. I've got very interested in it from a research perspective. And you might say, well, black holes, what have they got to do with anything? You know, they're weird objects. Everyone finds them fascinating. They're completely collapsed stars. We have a photograph of one now at the center of a nearby galaxy that is, believe it or not, 6 billion times the mass of our sun.
Wow.
That's astonishing, isn't it?
Yeah.
A black hole. But the really interesting thing about them is in trying to understand them, and this was really triggered by a question Stephen Hawking asked about 50 years ago now, and in trying to understand them, we've been driven to this, an understanding that reality, the physical reality that we see, is really not what it seems. It really does seem now that there's something more to reality. And actually, space and time themselves, right? So time, I always think time is the most human. The passage of time is such a deep part of being human, the fact that we get old, but we don't really know what time is. But it seems now from the study of black holes that it's emerging from something deeper, in the way that if you said, where's the economy of our country? Where's that? You know, it's obviously you can't really say where it is. It emerges from something deeper, which is the activity of people. It seems that the activity of something else is producing time. I mean, that's a remarkable thing. And so I explore that really cutting edge research into black holes. We're now even beginning to suspect that we're all holograms.
Oh.
Isn't that bizarre? So, genuinely.
No, don't say that.
It's crazy. That seems to be part of the story of what black holes are telling us. I just say that there's a wonderful quote from Einstein, and it really applies to black holes. In the context of black holes, it would be that you peer across the event horizon. And that's why my shows are called Horizons, one of the reasons. You peer across into the unknown. And what we've done is we've caught a glimpse of something deeply hidden. And that's Einstein's phrase, something deeply hidden. And the something deeply hidden is the underlying structure of reality itself.
I'm spellbound listening to you. But when you do these shows, Brian, in a sentence, how do you explain what is a black hole?
Well, part of the show is that I have these enormous screens. Think of an LED TV, right, that we've got in our living rooms, but it's 30 meters across by 8 meters high. And so I've generated some tremendous graphics, some of them with the help of the team that did the graphics for the film Interstellar, actually, because they did a beautiful black hole in Interstellar. So the pictures and graphics, and what I want to do is obviously have an entertaining show for that a 10-year-old can enjoy or a 90-year-old can enjoy, and you don't need to know anything to come to the show. And so part of it's just reveling in the weirdness of the universe. The more we try and understand it, as I said, the more bizarre it becomes.
It's fascinating, though, isn't it? Now, I know we can't move far during lockdown, but I did love the BBC series Wonders of the Solar System. And if you could have somehow been spending your lockdown, Brian, on one part of the solar system other than Earth, another planet or moon around a gas giant, and somehow, look, you could survive. Sorry, let's just say that. Where would it be and why?
I mean, I would love to stand on one of the moons of Saturn, and maybe Enceladus. It's this tiny little moon that has fountains of ice that rise up from the surface and actually form one of the outer rings of Saturn. But can you imagine the view from a moon orbiting around Saturn, looking at the rings, which is surely the most beautiful aspect or element of our solar system? I would love to see Saturn's rings close up.
Wow. The past year, Brian, before I let you go, it's been difficult enough because of COVID, and scientists have found themselves in, you know, pretty unusual and difficult positions. You have the whole thing of proven science versus conspiracy theories. And I think last year you were speaking about the politicization of scientific advice and how science and scientific advice could be blamed if decisions are made, which, as you put it, subsequently turn out to be suboptimal in some way. Do you still worry about that?
Yes. I mean, we see now, you know, that there's been an intense politicization of vaccines, you know, the pros and cons of different vaccines. And it's tremendously important that people have are confident in the vaccines that we're taking. Obviously, that's the route out of this pandemic. And I think there has been confusion and confusing advice, part of which has been political. I mean, some of it is just that it's a remarkable thing that we managed to, that, you know, if you go back 18 months, this disease did not exist in humans. It wasn't here. And the fact that we've been able to understand it and develop a series of vaccines, and all those vaccines seem, given the data that we've got now, to be extremely effective against it, is incredible. And I think that what there needs to be there is clarity, and not any sort of geopolitical posturing about who made what vaccine where and which one's the best and all this. What we seem to know from the data, as far as I can see, is that they're all very good and all significantly better than catching the disease.
Absolutely. Now, I know you enjoyed your time at the Young Scientists and Technology Exhibition, and you think it could be replicated in the UK. Yeah, you loved it, didn't you?
Yeah. It was just so wonderful because it was schools from every corner of the country coming together, and just a level of excellence. Maybe not surprising, because I know that young people are interested in science, but when you see that level of brilliance, right, just replicated again and again and again, school after school after school, it's uplifting, actually. I found it a really uplifting experience because I thought, well, the future is in safe hands.
And of course, they said a few years ago the Brian Cox effect had a huge impact in Britain and a lot more increase in students doing physics courses. So you must be pleased about that.
There were lots of reasons for the increase in science students. I mean, there's been a lot of effort put into getting more young people into science. So I really don't want to take credit for all of that, you know, but I suppose that, you know, television and radio, they do have an influence. So I think the more scientific voices you get on television and radio, the more people will be inspired. And I'll take a tiny credit for just being one of those voices.
And I'm going to mention now about how people can get tickets. But you, of course, used to be a rock star. For some of my listeners who may not know, is it a bit like gigging with D-Ream? And no, we're not going to play Things Can Only Get Better. But is doing the science tour and now the Space Odyssey tour, is it a bit like that for you?
Oh, they're way bigger shows. I'm way bigger than D-Ream. No, I'll tell you what, Peter Cunner's a very good friend of mine, so I'm not going to say that. It's similar in a way, you know, it's touring, but they're big audiences. There's a very big difference, which is that the thing I like best about an audience in an arena is the moment when you realize that I've said something that captured people's imagination. If I stop talking, it's silent. You realize that people are actually listening to what you're saying. And so, and that's the most remarkable feeling. It's completely the opposite in a band, of course. If you finish a song and there's silence, you know, that's not what you want.
No.
But in some ways, it's the opposite.
Well, look, it's been an absolute joy, and I'm sure my listeners are fascinated listening to you, Professor Brian Cox. And tickets for your show, Horizons, a 2021 Space Odyssey with Professor Brian Cox. It's taking place on the 15th of October in the Three Arena here in Dublin, and they're available from Ticketmaster. I'd say lots of people want to go. Thanks so much for talking to us this morning, Brian.
Thank you very much.
Mind yourself.